Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Ross, Judge Smith, the Honorable Lucinda E. Jessen presiding.
You may be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's December 12th, a wonderful snowy day. We have six matters on our calendar today. Four of them are oral. Marshall, will you call the first case?
Sure. First case is A19-1484 in the matter of the civil commitment of Lindsay Evan Brault appellants.
You both are pretty familiar with our rules, but counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes, as will you. Counsel will respond. Please introduce yourself when you come to the podium, which can be raised and lowered. There's a button on there if you want to do that. And counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. With that, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, Nicole Ann Rabel, here as court-appointed counsel for the appellant, Lindsay Evan Brault. The case before the court here today is about the constitutional rights of an individual to privacy, liberty, personal and bodily autonomy, weighed against competing governmental interests, specifically in regards to court-ordered treatment with neuroleptics. Neuroleptics alter the chemistry of an individual's neurological system, and the involuntary administration of neuroleptics was determined by the court through the cases Jarvis v. Jarvis and Price v. Shepard as an invasive form of treatment on level with electroshock therapy. And under Minnesota law through these cases, the rights of an individual are extremely protected when the court is considering treatment with neuroleptics. Specifically, these cases has held that the means utilized to serve the state's interest must be necessary and reasonable in light of alternative means and the least intrusive. The issues in this case is narrow. We're not arguing whether or not the appellant had capacity or if she met the standard for mentally ill as defined under Minnesota law. Instead, this is about Jarvis and its interpretation under the Civil Commitment Act. The first argument is that the court erred in interpreting Minnesota statute section 253B.092 by authorizing a Jarvis order without clear and convincing evidence of refusal. And second, that the court erred in finding that the reasonableness standards were met under Minnesota statute section 253B.092.
And maybe we could stop there because that is my big question for this case. What is your authority for the proposition that a patient's refusal to consent must be proven by clear and convincing evidence? I understand the initial commitment needs to be proven by clear and convincing evidence, but that seems to me to be quite different.
So our argument is that refusal under Minnesota statute 0.092 subdivision 7C or subdivision 7-8 is ambiguous in the time frame for refusal. Specifically, the statute says that under section A, if the substitute decision maker or the patient refuses to consent to treatment with neuroleptic medications and absent an emergency order set forth under subdivision 3.
Aren't those two different arguments? I mean, they're your arguments, so you'll tell me where I'm wrong. But I see you've got a statutory argument that says refusal is ambiguous.
Yes.
And then there's the question about, well, however we ultimately define that refusal, did she refuse?
Correct.
And when you're saying that to look at whether or not she refused, that I assume you're saying that the state should be proving that by clear and convincing evidence.
Correct, okay. Your Honor.
And I'm asking you, what's your authority for that? Because while I see the authority for commitment to be proven by clear and convincing evidence, I do not see where the statute says that's true when you're trying to prove refusal.
Well,
what a reasonable person, you know, would do in that situation.
The case law in Reboyne that says that any ambiguities in the Civil Commitment Act must be construed against the state and in favor of the person who's being deprived of their liberty. So we are arguing that minimally this would require clear and convincing evidence of refusal.
I don't understand try to connect the dots for me between your proposition you just made and the requirement for the standard of proof.
So the standard of review in looking at the court's case law in Peterson says that clear and convincing evidence in the record must support the conclusion that medication is necessary.
But yeah, wasn't the Peterson case before the statute was changed? Because I'm looking at subdivision 6, I think it's D, which talks about at a hearing the petitioner has the burden of proving incapacity, at least, by a preponderance of the evidence.
We're arguing also from the constitutional standpoint that clear and convincing evidence would be necessary for refusal as well.
Is there any question she refused at one point?
There is some question of refusal. When we're looking at the record, the testimony from the Jarvis examiner at the hearing was that she had been, first he was saying, I don't know what her compliance has been with medication since August 15th. The date of the hearing was August 22nd. Later he said, well, I received evidence that she's been taking medication for the last 3 days. But if we're looking at the guardian ad litem's report, this indicates that back on August 10th, she was saying, I'm going to take my medications because I don't want to be committed. On August 11th, I'm going to be taking my medications because I don't want to be Jarvis'd. Further, in the first examiner's report, she indicates that back on August 16th, she was taking her medications voluntarily and agreed to an increase in her Invega. So the issue of whether or not she's refusing is an argument that we're pushing here today, is that the record was unclear in this regard, or it's non-existent on some of those days as well. But the Jarvis examiner did say that he had information that at the time of the hearing, she was taking her medications. Also of note for the Jarvis examiner's testimony from before the court in front of the hearing was that he said, it's possible that at other points in the last 3 days she may have been taking these neuroleptic medications. And additionally, that there was no information about past efficacy of neuroleptics, which I'll go into in the reasonableness determination.
I want to make sure I understand your statutory interpretation argument, which I understand you saying is that when you're measuring refusal, it's at the court hearing itself. Is that fair to say?
Correct.
Or is it like 24 hours before? I mean, help us with this.
Yeah, our argument is that its current refusal should be determined under the statute when we're looking at it in light in favor of the appellant. But I do understand that there are some concerns if we're going to be determining if somebody's just accepting that day. And the volume of refusal could be many things. It could be a single instance of refusal, if the patient has ever refused neuroleptics, always refusing, if they're vacillating between refusance or acceptance. And what we're doing in this case is we're exposing a problem in how the courts are interpreting refuses under that statute. And it may be instructive of this court to provide a test for the lower courts to be interpreting what refusal means. My proposal is possibly a three-part test where we're looking at the nature and duration of refusal, second, the history of refusal and acceptance, and third, the patient's plan moving forward regarding taking neuroleptic medications.
So if you're suggesting these factors, I gather you're accepting the fact that this is a discretionary thing. You know, there's sort of a fluid understanding of what refusal means.
Correct, Your Honor.
Why would we say that in this case the standard wasn't met, given the fluidity that you're suggesting we apply to the definition?
The standard wasn't met because the record was unclear or lacking in regards to her refusal or acceptance. There's certain days where we have no information about what her compliance was with the medications.
I don't understand how your standard would apply to the revolving door concern that the state has introduced in this case.
How the standard would apply to this specific case from the appellant today is?
Well, the concern about, if the timing is as you suggested should be at the time of the hearing, it would be very simple for an individual to avoid involuntary medication simply by saying, all right, I don't refuse.
Correct.
And then get back to the hospital and say, I'm not accepting the medication.
Correct, and that's a concern that we have in how the courts are interpreting what refusal means, and that's why we're offering the test here today. And looking at this from a constitutional standpoint...
Wait, I don't know that you've addressed the question, though. I mean, how would your standard address that concern?
It would allow the courts to review many considerations in determining whether or not they need to issue an involuntary order for neuroleptic medications. Forcing somebody to take a medication when they're already complying would not meet the constitutional standard.
When you say already complying, that kind of sort of a circular argument, I think. What does already complying mean if your standard would allow an individual to say yes and then no and then yes and then no and prevent the order from ever applying?
That is
issuing.
That is a concern that the court may have, and that's why the standard would allow them to review these considerations. If there's a history of refusal, acceptance, then that might make sense to issue a Jarvis order to ensure compliance when the reasonable person standards are evaluated and met, and the capacity determination is met as well.
So I just want to make sure I understand you, because I'd read your brief, and perhaps I'm wrong, to suggest that it's really a point-in-time test. That when we're talking about kind of refusal, it's, you know, that day or at least that 24 hours. And now you're saying, no, it's really a three-part factor analysis.
No, you're correct, Your Honor. We're arguing that current refusal is what the statute should be interpreted as in its ambiguous language. But in the alternative, if the court were to look at this issue moving forward, since this is an issue of first review for this court, that might be a possibility to
have. Why would we get to the alternative if it's unambiguous? You're arguing that it's unambiguous, and that its unambiguous application would mean that it's at that point. And it gets back to my concern with your argument, which is you can have this revolving door that can't possibly what the legislature meant. So that's not what the statute means.
Correct, Your Honor. We had considered that in our argument, that if the legislature had interpreted Jarvis in relation to refusal, they could have said if the individual has a history of refusal or is currently refusing. But without that sort of indication or that interpretation, it's difficult and ambiguous for the courts to, or it's difficult for the court to determine what refusal is.
Tell me,
so we're arguing.
What's your primary argument? You've lost me here. Are you saying that this is an unambiguous statute, or are you saying that it's an ambiguous statute? What exactly are you asking us to do primarily?
We're saying that the statute is ambiguous in the time frame for refusal, and it must be interpreted as current refusal. That is what our argument is in regard to
unless we interpret it according to a three-part test.
Correct, Your Honor. In looking at our reasonableness analysis and the argument that the court erred in finding the reasonableness standard, under the law, when an incapacitated patient is voluntarily accepting neuroleptics, their wishes are conflicting or lacking, or if they're refusing neuroleptics, in all three of those circumstances, the court must consider the reasonableness factors. Specifically, Minnesota Statute 253B.092, Subdivision 7C, states in part, the decision must be based on what a reasonable person would do, taking into consideration the four factors. And our argument is that there was no evidence on three of those four factors presented before the court, so they could not have made that determination, and that finding is clear error.
So in a real world, you might have an individual whose history is unknown. So the background and the religious concerns and the other cultural concerns are simply unknown. If your standard applies, I gather you would say then that the court could never issue an order because there's no evidence presented on that concern, that factor.
That is an argument that was made in the respondent's brief as well, in the hearing on August 22nd, that it's not the examiner's responsibility to do an independent investigation of these. But we argue that that is exactly what their obligation is. It's their obligation to review these factors and present an opinion to the court in relation to these factors and making that reasonableness determination.
But I don't know, that addresses my concern. What happens in the real world where that evidence, that information is simply lacking because of there's an unknown element to the individual's background, which is not unforeseeable. I imagine it happens quite a bit. Find someone who's homeless and no idea what the person's religious views are or other cultural concerns are. You seem to be suggesting that unless there is this research and actual presentation on that question, you never have an order for involuntary medication.
We are arguing that, Your Honor, that the statute by its plain language says this decision must be based on these factors, and if these factors are not present.
It says these are considerations for the court. And doesn't that mean that if there are concerns, don't you begin with the presumption that there is no spiritual, religious background that would prevent the medication or the decision about medication, and just make, don't you have certain presumptions?
The statute doesn't allow for certain presumptions to be made in these regards, and it's up to the examiners in the court to take all of these into consideration, statute's requiring.
So I do want to come back to one of my earlier questions, and if you can't answer it now, maybe it's something you could address on rebuttal, because I do see, you know, there are these factors that are supposed to be taken into consideration, and all, not all of them were specifically addressed here. But that gets me to, you know, what's the burden of proof question, coming back to that. And I am looking at 253B.092 subdivision 6D that says at a hearing under subdivision 8, and that's the subdivision that talks about the procedure when the patient refuses medication, that the petitioner, the state, has the burden of proving incapacity by a preponderance of the evidence. Wouldn't that suggest that it's a preponderance of the evidence, not clear and convincing evidence standard, that ought to be addressed, that ought to be used when evaluating those reasonableness factors?
It's my understanding that that is the analysis to be made in the determination of capacity, which is not in question today. So we are arguing today that the court had erred in finding that Ms. Spreltz was currently refusing the neuroleptic medications, and the court's factual findings are reviewed under clear error. And this was made as the record was lacking in regard to her refusal, and also that the court had erred in finding the reasonable person standards when the statute standards were not in the record.
Thank you. Thank you. You'll have an additional time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent respondent the petitioner. An issue needs to be addressed that is not in any of the briefs, and it is from the Minnesota Supreme Court in Schmidt, and it relates directly to Judge Ross's question of what are you asking us to do? In this case, they're conceding that she does not have capacity to decide. They're conceding and stating that she wants to take the neuroleptic medication, and that she wants to take it into the future. So here's a person with no capacity who wants to take the drug and wants to take it into the future. And that's what was ordered. So under Schmidt, Minnesota Supreme Court, we must first determine whether we have jurisdiction to hear this case. We must consider the mootness question, even if ignored by the parties. The court will only decide actual controversies. If the court is unable to grant effectual relief, the issue raised is deemed moot and the resulting dismissal of the appeal. They're asking for an advisory opinion on the statute. They're not disagreeing with what she was ordered to do.
Sort of. I mean, there is some difference, just on a human level, between voluntarily ingesting medication and having it forced upon you, even if you generally consent. It seems like the mootness question, there's not just a theoretical distinction here between voluntary and involuntary consent and no consent medication.
Argument is that it's the involuntary nature of it, not that she's being ordered to take Invega, but that they also added the involuntary, then you could perhaps avoid the mootness question, but that would have to be it. And that's not what they've articulated. And once they've conceded that she is not competent to make the decision, you're going to be Jarvis'd, if you will. You have to. It's required by the statute. If she does not have capacity to consent, there has to be an order under the statute.
No, there's only has to be an order if it's appropriate given these factors, so any reasonable person would do this. It's not just you don't have capacity, so you're forced to take neuroleptic medication. That can't, that's not the law.
Nope, and that's correct. It's like, what I mean, though, is that it would have to come here, it would have to come to the district court. The district court would have to consider the subdivision 7 factors. And the district court did consider the subdivision 7 factors, and that's not what they're contesting. That's not their claim, is that that was inappropriate or that there was a mistake with that per se. If what their argument is that the force aspect was inappropriate.
Well, I assume that if someone doesn't have a Jarvis order, what patients often want, they want to decide, and maybe they're saying, I want to be able to take the medicine now. I agree. I'm taking it voluntarily. The person's taking it voluntarily now, even without the capacity, but at least wants the ability to change their mind instead of having the state just make that decision for them. That does not seem to me to be an unreasonable kind of basis for challenging a Jarvis order.
True, but they've conceded that away for the most part. So if I could step back for just a second. In a civil commitment case, all neuroleptic medication has to come through this statute. It has to come through 253B.092, whether you have capacity or whether you don't have capacity. And the statute lays out various ways that it can proceed, from voluntarily taking it to involuntarily taking it. But if you are civilly committed, and neuroleptic medications are going to be authorized, has to be through the statute some way. In this case, they concede that she does not have capacity to make the decision, which brings you to subdivision 7 of the statute. So you will then, the district court, properly analyze the subdivision 7 factors. The court then also said, we're going to allow involuntary administration as well under subdivision 8 by also applying the subdivision 7 factors, which is exactly what's required.
Mr. Zetlick, can I take you back to the refusal argument they're making that the statute's ambiguous as far as the kind of the timing aspect, how to measure that? Could you, and you didn't address that much in your brief, could you give us the state's position on that?
The statute's not ambiguous. If she's incompetent and the district court applies the subdivision 7 factors, the district court can order the involuntary administration. They don't have to wait. They don't have to run back and forth between the court and the hospital trying to find out if she's going to refuse or not.
So refusal is more than just a point in time.
Correct. It has to be.
What is the effect of the order of August 22nd in which Judge Offerman finds that she's been refusing medication? Does that make this res judicata as far as that fact?
I think that it certainly has that effect, and there's certainly evidence in the record to support the district court's order. So even if refusal is required, Ms. Briault came to the court having adamantly refused medication on initial admission. She came in acutely psychotic. She came in because she was a threat to others and herself. So she stayed in the hospital inpatient for almost several weeks, but up until about 3 days before the hearing, before she finally started to take the medication. And she also had two previous commitments where she ultimately refused to take the medication, and she was only taking the medication in the end because she didn't want to be Jarvis'd, in her words. And this court has, in previous cases, found that if the only reason they're taking it is to avoid being ordered to take it, that that's not a sufficient basis to avoid a Jarvis order.
Mr. Settler, you'd agree that it's the state's burden to demonstrate that she's refusing to take the neuroleptic medication. Correct?
I don't know. The statute doesn't say that. The statute doesn't say that we have to prove she's refusing before she can be ordered to take it involuntarily.
Well, I think reading even the transcript of the hearing here, there was an assumption by the state that it was the state's burden to demonstrate that.
I think the state did prove it, but I don't think the plain language of the statute requires it.
Well, then whose burden is it?
I'm sorry?
Then whose burden is it?
The district court can order the involuntary, under subdivision 8, the district court can order the involuntary administration of neuroleptics by applying the factors of subdivision 7.
If there's refusal?
The statute doesn't say that. It was proven in this case, so if refusal is required, it was certainly met in this case, but the plain language of the statute doesn't require it. Due process might require it, but the plain language of the statute doesn't.
Could we go to my burden of proof question?
Yes.
So, assuming that we've passed the refusal and we're into the reasonable person under considerations under subdivision 7, would you agree that it's the state's burden to make a showing on those factors? And if so, is it by clear and convincing evidence or a preponderance of the evidence?
The court has stated it both ways in opinions and generally says it's clear and convincing. But in the most recent, in Sharp, in a footnote, indicates it could be either. We don't have to decide because it's met under either.
In the state's position in this case?
I think that the statute does state by a preponderance, and I think that is the plain language of the statute.
And as to appellant's argument, well, that really just goes to capacity, not to these what would a reasonable person do. How would you address that?
It wouldn't make any sense for them to put that in there if that was the case, because it already applies to the commitment. Unless the court has any specific questions, I would just conclude by, again, reiterating that when you ask what they're asking for, what they're actually looking for, I think under Schmidt that this case is moot because they're applying the Subdivision 7 factors under Subdivision 7 for an incompetent person. And again, with the refusal, it requires them to apply the Subdivision 7 factors. So either way, it's the Subdivision 7 factors. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
In reviewing our argument for the court today, our argument is that the statute is ambiguous on the time frame for refusal, and therefore that must mean current refusal. But the test that we are offering is a method for the court to evaluate that. I also want to reiterate that it's not just that the record is lacking in regards to all four of those reasonableness standard factors, but also the order is not narrowly tailored, which is also required in the court's decision in Steen and Rabboin, stating that each order must, of necessity, be tailored to the circumstances of the individual situation, and the order, and in Rabboin, the order must be sufficiently tailored to the specific circumstances in order to protect the patient's rights. The order, the Jarvis order in this proceeding was just simply straightforward. It had determinations saying, just we've reviewed and we've considered these four factors, but did not make explicit findings on each of them. It says the patient is either refuses or has a history of refusing. It doesn't evaluate
that. The statute doesn't say that there needs to be specific findings. It just says they need to be considered. I mean, and we have a number of statutes that's thinking of the family law area where, you know, courts, district judges have to make specific findings on things. Why should we read that into this statute?
The statute doesn't say that it needs specific findings, but the court's case law in Steen and Rabboin say that it needs specific findings and it needs to be narrowly tailored to Ms. Brelt's situation.
Usually the findings must be specific so that the purpose being appellate review. If you have findings that are insubstantial, then we have a difficult time on review deciding how to address the appellant's argument. In this case, if we're satisfied that the findings are sufficient for us to address the substantive arguments, doesn't that defeat your position regarding findings of fact being inspecific?
Our argument is that the findings are clear error, but also that the record doesn't have information on all of those factors in order for the court to say that they have considered those factors, making that finding clear error.
I was talking about your argument that the findings are not sufficient, not whether they're supported.
Correct. The findings are not sufficient when we look at Steen and Rabboin.
Right, my question for you goes to that. I don't know that you've answered that question. Usually we consider the sufficiency of the findings based on our concern that there's not enough in the record. There's not enough for us to evaluate what the district court was doing and to decide whether the district court acted within its discretion in making its decision. In this case, if we're satisfied that the findings are sufficient for us on review, that there's enough there for us to discern either expressly or implicitly the basis of the district court's decision, why do we need to have more sufficient findings?
If the court finds that the record has sufficient information for the court to make that determination, then that would be sufficient. But I would argue that the order itself needs to be narrowly tailored. And specifically when we're looking at the reasonableness factors, number three, past efficacy in any extenuating circumstances of past use, no evidence was presented in this regard. The Jarvis examiner in his testimony says that he only presumed that she had been prescribed neuroleptic medications before. The only discussion of past neuroleptics for Ms. Brelt was a note in the Guardian Ad Litem's report saying that Ms. Brelt told the hospital staff that she had previously been prescribed and she listed out medications. The only information the court had was a self-report from somebody who they determined was incapacitated in regard to this. And this is significant because this factor is important. She could have had allergic reactions or significant side effects in regards to these neuroleptics, and that was not considered.
Could you address, please, the mootness argument that Mr. Zettler made?
I apologize. The mootness argument in regards to?
He was suggesting that the case was really moot. You're asking for an advisory opinion, given that your client's position is that she is voluntarily willing to take the neuroleptic medication.
She is voluntarily taking the neuroleptic medication, but the court made a finding that she is refusing, and that would be clear error in this regard. So we're asking.
It's clear error because she's agreeing to take the medication. Doesn't that make this case moot?
That doesn't make this case moot because we're asking for an error. We're asking for a decision that the court had committed clear error, and we're also asking for reversal and dismissal of the Jarvis order entirely. We're asking the court to rule that a court may not issue an order for forced administration of neuroleptics when an incapacitated patient's not currently refusing, and refusal is not present in this case because it's not current refusal. And we're also asking the court to determine that the lower court committed clear error in finding clear and convincing evidence of refusal. Additionally, that the court in this case committed clear error in finding clear and convincing evidence of forced administration of neuroleptics is reasonable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your arguments. The matter will be taken under advisement and a decision will be issued within the statutory time period. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Carloba Adams-Powell. I'm here on behalf of Appellant Michelle McDonald. We are here